Before we get into tonight's topic, any questions about the meditation instructions or how to be mindful on all these different levels as you meditate? Not that I can remember. Maybe. I mean, I'm sure there's been times when I was meditating and nauseous, especially the times when I was meditating in India and I had a bad case of Giardia. I'm sure I was nauseous a lot of the times then. But as sort of your question, which I assume is just as a side effect of normal, healthy body meditating, feeling nauseous, doesn't happen for me. Other people have that experience?
I get
dizziness. Could happen. I mean, I assume that that happened for you tonight. You got a little nauseous. And where did the, is just the, that kind of contraction in the stomach? Yeah. And what'd you do about it? Did you open your eyes or... No, just kept meditating with it. And pleasant or unpleasant?
Unpleasant, but it comes and goes.
Comes and goes. And was there any ability to meet the unpleasantness with compassion or kind of some, at least tolerance or some, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Whatever happens during meditation, whether it's nausea or dizziness or whether it feels really good or really bad, so much of our practice is to just accept it as it is, not necessarily needing to do anything about it, but to meet it in the appropriate way, which the beginning of it is tolerance, is just tolerating that unpleasant, nauseous feeling. Eventually, we would like to get to the place where we can have full compassion for that pain rather than just tolerating it. And you will get there if you want to. So it could have been a byproduct of meditation, and maybe it's something you ate. Never know. Please.
I got a question following up on that. You talked about meeting something that's unpleasant with compassion. Okay. Now, I know if I see a puppy in the rain with a broken leg, that I can have compassion. How do I know that I'm having compassion for the pain in my ass as I'm sitting here?
Well, you'll know when you have the direct experience of treating your ass like a puppy with a broken leg in the rain.
Right.
Because the definition of compassion, this word, this Buddhist word, karuna, is an actual, it's a quivering of the heart. So like when you see that suffering being, puppy, and you're moved by it, you know, there's this feeling of, you know, and you feel it, you feel compassion for it. And so when we get to the place of having compassion, even for our own pain, we'll know it, because we'll feel it, like, oh, this hurts, and I care about it. Just like I would care about someone else's suffering. I've come to the place of caring about my own suffering. So you'll know. And until you know it, until you get there, we just keep attempting. We keep trying to treat our asses like the, you know, destitute, homeless puppy. But even that, even just that trying is different, right? Most of us, we came here, we never tried to be very compassionate with ourselves. Never attempted, never even thought it was a good idea. Maybe still you don't think it's a good idea. It's a sort of, it's a rare commodity. It's a very, I think it's a very Buddhist concept to be compassionate with your own pain and not just altruistic towards other people's pain, but to bring that compassion inward. I don't know of many other philosophies that encourage it as much as Buddhism does. So, and it takes some work. It takes quite a bit of time to develop that sense. And then when you get there, you will know. It'll feel spontaneous and real. And you'll know. So for the last while or so, I don't know how long, months, we've been trying to get through this, or I've been trying to get through this series of teachings on the Eightfold Path, and for the last several classes I've been talking about the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, which is about mindfulness. Right mindfulness. What is called, what the Buddha called, the four foundations of mindfulness. And by my estimation, we're on the fourth foundation. We spoke in depth weeks ago about the first foundation, mindfulness of the breath, of the body, of the 32 parts of the body, of the impermanent nature of the body becoming a corpse, of the postures and activities of the body. All of that, first foundation of mindfulness. So if you've been meditating for a long time and you are still just paying attention to your breath, you're only doing a very small aspect of what the Buddha encouraged us to do for mindfulness. You're only mindfulness of the breath is only the first of the first eighth of a quarter of the four foundations of mindfulness. I know that's a lot of math. So first foundation, breath, body. Second foundation, feeling tone. What's it feel like as we pay attention to the present time, the body, the breath, the emotions? Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? As you breathe in, as you bring attention to your ass, it's unpleasant. Naming that, knowing this is pain. What's our response to pain? How are we relating to pain? Are we able to meet pain with compassion, or are we doing the habitual reaction of meeting it with anger, with aversion, with resistance? How about pleasure? When something pleasurable happens, are we able to meet it with non-attached appreciation, or are we meeting it with clinging, with craving, with wanting more, with feeling disappointed when the pleasure passes, grieving the loss because of the clinging, because of the attachment? So second level of mindfulness is really seeing clearly how we create suffering, how we're fully responsible for how we create our own suffering based on our relationship to the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. When we learn to meet pain with compassion, there's just pain, no suffering. And this is incredibly important. I asked you in the end of the meditation, what's standing between you, what's blocking or hindering your happiness in this moment? I'd imagine for most of us it was this sort of feeling of like, well, I'm uncomfortable. I've been sitting still for 30 minutes, and if I wasn't in pain, if I was comfortable, then maybe I'd have a shot at happiness. So from a Buddhist perspective, happiness does not equal pleasure. Happiness does not equal the absence of discomfort or pain. But happiness, which I feel is a very realistic goal, happiness means being okay with the pain. Having compassion for the pain, not needing it to go away. Accepting it as it is, and still being at ease, even though it's painful. Happiness means appreciating pleasure and knowing that it's impermanent, not being addicted to it feeling good, life feeling good, our bodies feeling good, our minds feeling good, in order to be happy. But the Buddhist definition of happiness is much closer to contentment with life as it is. Breaking a dependence on circumstances being a certain pleasurable way. So the second foundation points us at that liberating transformation of changing from the normal, I'm only happy when I'm getting my way and everyone's paying attention to me and it's pleasurable and then I'm happy. And if it's painful, if it's difficult, if it's uncomfortable, I am unhappy. So Buddhism offers a transformation of that into the possibility of well-being in any circumstance. The third foundation, I believe we spoke about last week, which is expanding from just the physical body of the first foundation to also the mental process. Was that last week? Yeah. And the third foundation, really bringing attention to how the mind works and the different states of mind that arise and beginning to have a relationship to our mind rather than only from it, rather than being so identified with the mind that we just do whatever our mind tells us to, breaking that. What to me, when I started doing mindfulness practice, really it was amazing to see that I had a choice. My whole life, up until when I started meditating, I just did whatever my mind told me to do. And my mind gave really bad advice. Really bad advice. And so this third foundation of mindfulness starts to see, oh, the mind is an organic process, it's conditioned. These thoughts arise, emotions are also part of the mental phenomena, arise in the mind, experienced in the body. And we begin to see they don't have as much power as we thought once we bring an awareness to it. Seeing it, watching it, observing it. And at times defying it, bringing this sort of breaking the addiction and defying the mind. At times. Which brings us, on some level, that's a brief overview of the first three, to the fourth foundation of mindfulness. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is called awareness or mindfulness of the truth, of the Dharma, or the Dharmas. So in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha says, after paying attention to the breath and body, feeling, tone, and process of mind, then just kind of see what's true about the present moment. And the first thing in the fourth foundation is he reviews the Four Noble Truths. He says, in the present moment, are you experiencing the First Noble Truth? The First Noble Truth being the truth of suffering. Is there suffering present right now? If there is, be mindful of it. How is suffering manifesting in your mind, in your body? If suffering is present, investigate what's causing this suffering, the second noble truth. What form of craving or aversion or identification? Be mindful of it. What am I craving for? What's this craving feel like? How's it manifest in my body? What sort of thoughts are associated with this craving? So bringing mindfulness to the process of creating our suffering. The third noble truth. Is there an absence of suffering? Are you experiencing nirvana in this moment? Are you free from suffering here now? Be mindful of those moments where there's no suffering. And if we're mindful pretty consistently, you will see lots of moments throughout your day where you're not craving for anything, you're not aversive to anything, you're not suffering. You're having mini nirvana experiences, temporary liberation. There's those moments. Most of us experience those moments as boring. If you're mindful of those moments where the suffering has ceased, usually you'll find that you go create some suffering for yourself. Not much is going on. I'm totally peaceful right now. This isn't fun. I need to have some pleasure. Or perhaps create some pain. Because in my own experience, might not be the same as yours, but what I've seen in the mindfulness and in those moments of experiencing serenity is that there's this deep conditioning in me for intensity. I want it to feel strong. I want to have a passionate, invigorating experience of life. And so often when I'm totally at peace, when I'm experiencing that liberated non-suffering, it's not that satisfying. I wanted liberation to be intensely pleasurable. Such a disappointment to find out that nirvana doesn't feel good all of the time. That sometimes it's very neutral. That those moments of non-craving, non-aversion, non-delusion can be very blah. At other times they can be very pleasurable and there can be no suffering. They can be very painful and there can be no suffering. But for myself, I find it most easy to identify the neutral moments. Because if it's painful, probably I'm meeting with some aversion. If it's pleasurable, probably I'm clinging. If it's neutral, those are the moments throughout the day that I experience the mini nirvana, and that often I notice that I go looking for trouble. Not so good at hanging out in serenity, in peace, in non-suffering. Getting a little bit better at it over the years, but still not so good at it. So that's a piece of, does that make sense? To be mindful of what's true about this moment. Are you suffering? Be mindful of dukkha. How is dukkha suffering, dissatisfaction? What's the direct experience in your body? Where's the craving? What's the direct experience of craving? What kind of mind states? When craving is absent, be mindful of its absence and watch where your attention goes from there. The second aspect of this truth, present moment truth, dharma of the present, is where the Buddha talks about the five hindrances. The five things that tend to get in our way, that tend to hinder us from being happy, from being at ease, from being free. Content. So I'm curious if you're willing to share, when I asked you what was blocking your happiness in that moment, what was it? Who wants to share? Do you remember what came up in that reflection? Please.
At first I was really angry that I couldn't connect with it, but I knew, I felt it was there. Strong presence, and it's been around for some time, days maybe, and I just went to the root of fear. I knew it was fear-based, So once I admitted, I heard myself admit that, I became more intimate with it, and then it became more specific. It was about beating myself up for missed opportunities, for not making more out of my life. Mm-hmm. So then I went into that later, and it became, I traced it all the way back to how I grew up in that, conditioning. And then I actually shifted.
It passed.
Yeah, but it started with a silent scream, and then it kind of strung itself completely.
So you have named at least two of the five hindrances in that experience. Anger being a form of aversion, hatred, fear also connected with anger. Usually fear is what's motivating the anger. So that being a huge hindrance, aversion to the way it is, whether it's manifesting as fear or as anger. And then the second one, which I'll talk more about, that I would classify that experience of kind of self-criticism that you're pointing to as doubt. What the Buddha talks about, self-doubt, self-criticism in that way. I fucked up. I didn't do the right thing. I'm not capable of doing the right thing. Whatever it is. Self-doubt as being a natural and universal experience that all human beings contend with. And that gets in our way a lot. So, aversion and doubt. Did anybody else experience something different than aversion or doubt? Joseph? And so that sort of feeling like, if I had food, then I could be happy. Which maybe is totally true and doesn't have to be neurotic. But as you know, that would be one of the other main hindrances, which is the feeling of need, of craving. Of I can't be happy until I get something that will be pleasurable, like dinner. So some form of craving being a hindrance, rather than the possibility of hunger is present, but I can still be okay. I can still be happy, even though my body needs to eat. I don't have to postpone my happiness until after dinner. I can have it now and still experience the craving and the happiness and the hunger.
Mm-hmm.
So, multiple hindrance attack of sloth, right? First, the sleepiness, which is the kind of, I'll talk more about it, but the sleepiness, which can be a form of laziness or procrastination or just physical tiredness, but what the Buddha called sloth and torpor, right? So that's the initial experience, and then the aversion, right? Then the anger, the second. So often it's not just one hindrance, but it's I'm sleepy and I'm hungry and I fucking hate myself and I'm never going to get good at meditating. And so it's the sloth, it's the aversion, it's the doubt all coming at the same time. Please.
Normally when I meditate, I tend towards seeking cessation of mind and emotion. Golden influx and prana movement through the body. And so when you said that, I was just like, oh, and just said, oh, it can be happy in this moment, and just kind of released whatever interior clamp down I had on the emotions, and then like a smidgen of joy rose, and then I thought about something else. And
passed, yeah. Yeah, and it's wonderful to do that kind of investigation because sometimes when we just ask, we're not even aware that we're attached or we're craving, or and then when you just say, well, it's blocking it, and you say, well, nothing has to be blocking it right now. I can be okay with it just as it is. Yeah. Was there another hand? Okay, so what didn't we get? I'm sure somebody was experiencing restlessness. The fucking, when is he going to ring the bell? Stop asking us questions and ring the fucking bell. My body is uncomfortable. And so that experience of restlessness being sometimes manifesting as anxiety, but being something that's difficult to contend with. And that during meditation, it can be very challenging if we get into a lot of restlessness and we really don't want to pay attention or don't want to be still. So the five hindrances are craving, aversion, restlessness, sloth, and doubt. So whenever these are present, yeah, please.
When you rang the bell, I thought it was like only like 10 minutes. I was going, I thought he should have 30 minutes.
Yeah, cheated you out of the other 20. There is something about a group that can be more supportive for meditation and time. Also having the guided meditation, the instructions can help us, guide us through. 30 minutes at home alone can feel like an eternity sometimes. But also, is this your first time in class?
Or you've been, class.
Yeah, in my class. You've sat with other groups though, meditated with other groups?
Yeah. It didn't work that way there.
Yeah, so it just depends. You know, sometimes there's that experience of maybe grace, for a lack of a better word, where there's that, you know, it's easy and it's pleasurable and it feels like it goes fast. And other times it's like, even here in the group, I feel like that was an eternity. And I'm sure that it was more than 30 minutes, right? That felt like an hour. So just perception is different each time, I think, in meditation. It's never the same meditation twice, my experience. So this fourth foundation and pointing towards the hindrances, one, it's very wonderful because it normalizes what we're going to experience. You're going to experience doubt. You're going to experience restlessness, sleepiness, aversion, craving. There's nothing wrong with you. That is universal. Everyone that has a body and a nervous system and a mind and is going to experience these things at times. And if they're not related to skillfully, with wisdom and compassion, they're going to create suffering. They're going to block freedom, block happiness. Something that is incredibly important, and both good news and bad news, is that the hindrances are never going to go away. So if you're thinking that if you meditate enough, you will never experience restlessness again, then I've got news for you. If you're thinking that if you meditate enough, you'll have so much confidence and faith and wisdom that you will never experience doubt again, that's not the way it works. What happens through the process of meditation and awakening and the Buddha's experience and the experience that's available to all of us, like everything else, is a transformation of our relationship to these hindrances. Is an acceptance of them. And the ability to respond appropriately. Oh, it's aversion. I know what's called for compassion. Oh, I'm craving again. I know what's called for releasing, letting go, and having the ability to respond with non-attachment. Oh, there's doubt again. Big surprise. Of course there's doubt. Of course my mind is going to be making comments and have its judgments, not taking it personal. Doubt's going to arise. It's part of the ego mechanism. It's part of the mind. It's not your fault. In many ways, we could say that it was the Buddha's temporary victory over the hindrances that led to his experience of nirvana. in the historical, partially mythological story of Siddhartha Gautama and the Buddha. He said, after 7 years of intensive seeking and spiritual discipline, he finally took that seat. He said, I'm going to sit here underneath this Bodhi tree, underneath this tree, until I get enlightened, until I figure out what causes suffering and experience the end of suffering. And if you know the story, in the myth, it's said that he's attacked by this being called Mara. Mara, in my opinion, is just an analogy for the difficult mind states that he experienced in his meditation. And Mara came as aversion and restlessness and sleepiness and craving and doubt. Mara is the personification of the five hindrances. And the Buddha sat there all night and he saw craving and he saw aversion and he saw doubt and he saw sleepiness and he saw restlessness. And rather than taking them personal and getting upset about it, he started to radiate compassion towards the pain that he was previously aversive to. He started to radiate acceptance. And not to take personal the impermanent mind states that were arising. At dawn, the next morning after sitting through the night, it is said that Siddhartha Gautama became a fully enlightened being and won his battle with Mara, with the hindrances. Not because they went away, but because he didn't take them personal. Not because all of a sudden his mind stopped experiencing doubt, aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, or craving. But because he saw how impersonal restlessness, sleepiness, craving, aversion, and doubt are. Because he transformed his inner relationship to the mind. And in the mythological presentation of this, as a battle with this being, with Mara, he says, Mara, I've seen through you and you're vanquished and go away forever. And Mara sulks off. Fucking Buddha. Saw through my tricks. And so most of the time, Buddhists end the story there and don't acknowledge that the very next day, right? A lot of time Buddha is presented as this totally perfect, non-human, godlike being that doesn't have the kind of emotions that we have, that doesn't have the kind of difficulties that unenlightened human beings like us have. But the truth is, in the sutras, in the scriptures, the very next day, Mara comes back. He's not gone forever. But what has happened forever is that the Buddha has seen through Mara, has seen through the hindrances. Mara comes back over and over and over to the fully enlightened Buddha. Connotation being, even in the enlightened mind, there's still doubt. There's still aversion. There's still cravings. There's still restlessness and experience and sloth. But every time Mara comes back after the Buddha gets enlightened, he just has this relationship with Mara. He says, I see you, Mara. I'm totally aware of you, and I know that you are not who I am. I don't believe in you anymore. And then Mara kind of says, okay, well, I was just checking. Right? I was just making sure you're still paying attention. And you are. So, you know, I'll come back next week to see. You know, I'll hit you with some strong lust next week. See if you're still paying attention. I'll hit you with some real anger in a month or two. See if you're still paying attention. And every time, and what separates enlightened beings from non-enlightened beings is that an enlightened being, a Buddha, not just the historical one, but I believe many, many beings over the centuries, have the ability to not take the mind so personally, to not suffer when these difficult emotions arise, when this difficult life experiences come. Personally, I think it's total bullshit if someone says enlightened beings no longer experience difficult emotions, no longer experience craving or aversion. Or it's not a lobotomy. It doesn't work like that. You don't get rid of your mind, your emotions, your nervous system. You don't get rid of your testosterone or your libido. It doesn't wipe out your humanness, spirituality. It doesn't get rid of your personality. Maybe that's bad news. Maybe some of us were hoping, if I'm spiritual enough, I won't have to be me anymore. Enlightenment and the kind of mindful path of Buddhism offers a perfection of perspective. Seeing clearly. Being awake to reality. Not changing the personality necessarily. Certainly not getting rid of the mind and its difficult mind states or the body and its uncomfortable experiences. Our only hope is to be mindful of the hindrances, as the Buddha is asking us to here in the fourth foundation. If we're mindful, if we're consistently present in our experience, and we'll learn to not take our experience so personally. We'll learn to respond with wisdom and compassion to our experience. We'll become more and more awake, less and less victims or addicted to or identified with the mind's cravings and aversions. And we'll begin to, as the Buddha said, I see you, Mara. I see you. Just doubt. I think it's a little bit of what your experience was tonight. Right? You, as you brought the attention to the fear and the doubt, you saw through it, and then it passed. When we're not paying attention, like you said, it can run us for days because we're not really paying attention to it, and it's unconsciously motivating all kinds of stuff. But mindfulness has the power to see through it and to let it pass. Not to get rid of it, not to avoid it, but to see through it and let it pass in its own impermanent nature. The hindrances in your meditation practice also have some traditional antidotes. When the mind's getting into a lot of doubt, whether it's self-doubt, that kind of thought pattern that says, I can't do this, I'm never going to be good enough or spiritual enough or disciplined enough or whatever the kind of self, I can't thoughts. Or it's the kind of doubt in the philosophy of like, this is bullshit. The Buddha, I don't even think that this is possible, right? That's also a doubt. So the antidote to doubt on some level is faith. And not blind faith, but verified faith. I know for myself, and I'd imagine for most of you, you have some experience with meditation now. And you've seen out of your own direct experience that it does work, that mindfulness is useful. Maybe we haven't got to the place like the Buddha where we can be not take the mind personal the way that he did. Maybe we haven't got to that kind of liberation, but we've seen the progress that happens when we're mindful. And so then in that doubt, we can reflect on, but it's working so far. I have confidence in my own direct experience that when I'm mindful, I suffer less. And the Buddha seemed to be right about this mindfulness stuff. So maybe I can have some confidence, some faith, that he was right, that it's actually possible to end suffering. So verified faith being much more important than any sort of blind faith in a philosophy or in someone else. But confidence in I've tried it, it works, and I will continue. I've seen that in the kind of continuum of the Dharma being kind of A through Z. And, you know, X, Y, Z maybe being enlightenment and karma and reincarnation and those sort of far-off experiences. Maybe karma can be down here around A, B, C, but anyways. And mindfulness and kindness and generosity being the kind of A, B, C basic. And saying mindfulness works, generosity works, kindness works. So out of direct confidence through experience, I have some faith that XYZ might be true too, even though I'm not there yet. I haven't gotten there yet, but I'm somewhere along the path, maybe around E or F, somewhere along the path. And it gives me confidence in the end of the path. That makes sense. The antidote to restlessness is usually some level of relaxation. Often restlessness means that there's too much effort. So softening, relaxing is an antidote to restlessness. Antidote to sloth is more effort. It's kind of enlivening, energizing, opening the eyes, straightening the posture, taking a walk, washing your face. Bringing some more energy to life, to the practice. The antidote to craving is letting go. Non-attachment. You see you're attached, let go. And or, sometimes the Buddha says, if you're in the craving, try to reflect on the unprofitability of this craving. Try to reflect on, you know where craving brings you. How unprofitable it is, what a waste of time it is. You know that you're just going to suffer if you stay lost in this craving. Sometimes that works as an antidote. Maybe I can just let go. Same thing with aversion. The antidote to the suffering of aversion is compassion. And sometimes reflecting on, okay, I'm in pain and I'm pissed off. Does being pissed off work? Has it ever worked? Has it ever gotten rid of my pain by meeting it with hatred and anger? Clearly, no. It's a losing proposition. Sometimes that helps to let go of the anger. To say the only thing that works is compassion. Is meeting the pain with kindness and mercy. And so starting to attempt that, even if we're not very good at it. Even if we attempt to be compassionate and we continue to fail, at least trying, having the intention to be compassionate until it becomes genuine. So those are some of my thoughts about mindfulness and the Four Noble Truths and the Five Hindrances. The Tibetans took this teaching from the Buddha and said, you know, this understanding that you're not going to get rid of the hindrances. And they said, it's like we all have demons. And we're also afraid of our demons. Often our demons are the pain that we're aversive to, or, you know, the craving or the doubt, that self-doubt. It turns into this sort of demon in our life. And they turned it into this philosophy. They said, the only hope is not to try to slay the demons or get rid of them, because you can't kill them, ever. But to invite the demons in for tea. that that's the only hope, that that's the way to relate to the hindrances. It's just doubt. Have a cup of coffee. The wonderful thing is that by their very nature, they have no choice because they're impermanent. They're just emotions. They're just sensations. They can't stay no matter what. It's actually our fear and our aversion of the demons, of the hindrances, that keeps them around longer than if we just bring them in with acceptance and say it's just sloth and it comes through. It's just restlessness and it comes through and it leaves. When we embrace, when we open to, when we have the attitude of the Buddha that says, I see you as you are, impermanent. They come through and they leave all by themselves. And then they come back, and then they leave, and then they come back, and then they leave. And that's the, that's being human. It's the way it is. There's no magic spiritual pill that's going to get rid of your mind or your emotions. But mindfulness is an incredibly practical way to deal with it and to end the struggle and the suffering about it. Any other thoughts or questions or comments? That's about all I have to say about that. Please.
Mm-hmm. If I'm understanding right, the instruction, I get the importance of understanding doubt or craving to be outside of myself, and I think that's really helpful. And that the instruction is not to dismiss them, but to explore them. Is that, because I think part of what I'm feeling with doubt is that I think that there's been times where doubt is the thinking brain, but it's been a good friend to inform the
this isn't right, yeah. Right. I think that that's very important. Because, yes, doubt comes from the mind, the ego, and there's times we don't want to dismiss it all of the time when there's that feeling of like this is unsafe or unhealthy. Oh, that's just doubt. Right? And walk into harm's way. So, for sure, discernment is necessary. How to come to the wisdom or discernment, I can't. There's no kind of magic line of like, well, if it's about this, it's neurotic and it's Mara, and if it's about this, it's healthy. That discernment has to come from our own direct experience. The more we're mindful, the more we observe the mind, the more we'll be able to tell whether this is sort of neurotic doubt, Mara doubt, or this is actually a healthy reminder that maybe this situation isn't safe or healthy or practical. But that's very important. I don't want to paint a picture at all that says all doubt is bad. Psychologically, I think that doubt is coming from the ego or perhaps the superego. That is that part of our mind that's trying to protect us. And it's made for that. It's made to protect us, to keep us alive. It's way out of balance. It's out of balance to the point where we're mostly judging ourselves and criticizing ourselves and doubting ourselves. It turns into low self-esteem and self-hatred. And it's way out of balance. But the core of it is, be careful, is what it's saying. Try to avoid pain, is what it's saying. Avoiding pain is impossible, which is why it's so critical and it's so becomes so neurotic, because it becomes so, takes it so personal that your mind is saying avoid pain, and you're not able to avoid pain, and then your mind's pissed off. You got me into all of this pain, but it was impossible to avoid it. So if that makes sense, you know, it's, we're not getting, that's why again I say we're not getting rid of it, but we can transform our relationship to it. At the end of the Buddha's life, many of you have heard me tell this story a lot of times, the last half of the Buddha's life, his cousin, who was a monk and was part of the Sangha that he was leading, decided that he was pissed off at the Buddha. He decided, his cousin's name was Devadatta, he decided he wanted to be the Buddha. He decided, I want to run this shit. I'm tired of him getting all the props, all the attention. He's the Buddha, I'm just the cousin. And he decided that he was going to kill the Buddha. He said, I'll take him out, and then what? I'm his cousin, they'll put me in charge, right? I'm a blood relative. And so he started to plot how to kill the Buddha, and he did a few different things. But at one point, he rolled a large boulder down this cliff at the Buddha. And so you could see, as the Buddha was kind of standing there and this boulder was coming at him, if he would have been unwise and said, no, it's just doubt. I'll be okay. Or there's the fear of the boulder. Oh, no, that's just Mara. Right? And then the boulder would have got him. So it's not all fear is Mara. It's not all doubt. He's not really trying to kill me. That's just in my mind. No, he's really trying to fucking kill me. And so the Buddha stepped out of the way. And the boulder smashed his leg, smashed his foot. And he experienced the pain. And I'm sure Mara came to the Buddha really strong that day in the form of aversion, in the form of hatred and resentment. But again, the Buddha radiated compassion towards the pain rather than plotting revenge. And he did have a healthy boundary, and he said, Devadatta, time for you to go away. He didn't say, okay, keep trying to kill me. He said, you're banished. Right? He said, this relationship's not workable anymore. This isn't just doubt. This is verified. Time for you to go away.
You've talked about Buddhism before as being against the stream, or that the Buddha says that these practices are against the stream. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, why the Buddha didn't come up with something that wasn't against the stream. That, I don't know, like, some way, like, that we could be happy and yet not have to go so much against our own nature. I don't know if that's a question.
I don't know either. My feeling is that if it were possible to just go with the normal human nature and also really find the kind of happiness that we're looking for, that somebody would have discovered it. That the Buddha would have discovered it, that somebody would have discovered it. What feels clear to me in my life's experience and my experience with Buddhism is that it is a form of rebellion, that it is a radical departure from the norm. The norm is to suffer. The norm is to be driven by greed and by hatred and by delusion. To take everything personal and to live a life based on hindrances and to constantly wonder, how come I'm not happy? But that's the norm. So I think that if it were possible to kind of, if there was an easier, softer way, that it would have been discovered. Or maybe it has been. And it's called Christianity. Just accept baby Jesus, and you'll be fine. I apologize to any Christians in the room for my blasphemy.
Well, both Christ and Buddha begged his followers not to found religions based on that.
What's that?
both Christ and Buddha begged his disciples not to found a religion and make icons of him and just follow his teachings. Both.
Yeah, that seems true.
Humans don't listen.
No, we don't. We'll fuck everything up. So that's enough for tonight. Thanks for your participation. And like everything, don't take my word for any of this. Don't believe any of it based on blind faith, but reflect on it. Find out for yourself, does this make sense? Is it true? Do I have the ability to change my relationship to my mind? Question it. And that, even that kind of questioning, it's not doubt. It's a healthy investigation. You know, you should bring some healthy skepticism to all spiritual teachings and trust your own direct experience. The Buddha ended most of his lectures, his sermons, with the words, "It is now time for you to do as you see fit." I've shared with you the Dharma of my understanding. Now you better do your own thing. A couple of announcements. There is a 5-week Tuesday night class, 4 or 5 weeks.